Welcome to Sports Symphonies.
We're to blame it. We play like blaming on me. I think we're in the point to have a lot of meetings. I'm not protecting anybody anymore.
You know, you play at the end, but the call by the officials, it's flat out chicken.
That one's drilled deep to left field. Going back, Joyce, looking up. See ya. 3,000. History with an exclamation point.
The footballing gods are looking down on Real Madrid. Dropping their big white beards and seeing Ramanos Muchachos.
We couldn't do diddly poo offensively. We couldn't make a first down. We couldn't run the ball. We didn't try to run the ball. We couldn't complete a pass. We sucked.
Hello and welcome to the Sports Symphonies podcast. My name is Justin Fries, coming to you from a balmy and warm Winston-Salem, North Carolina. That's right, I'm on the road this week, but here I am. Still in your ears. I'm a trooper, just like my compatriots this week in Boston, Massachusetts. They should have let him sing the national anthem in Miami. It's Raphael Coburn.
Look, I'm not a murderer, and I've never killed anyone, but that little girl singing that song really, really hurt me very deeply.
It's enough to drive anyone to things you never would have considered before. That's certainly true. And in Corvallis, Oregon, you won't have Guinness at his Irish wedding. It's Owen McMurtry.
I'm in Bend, Oregon now, Justin, which is probably about as far from Corvallis as the length of three of those wimpy little eastern states.
I don't think there's actually places in Oregon. I'm pretty sure it's all just woods and rain. That's my impression of it anyway. Yeah.
Actually, Bend's in a desert. Go figure. It just shatters your perception of Oregon.
I don't even know what to think anymore.
There's desert in Oregon?
The entire eastern half of Oregon is a desert.
What? That's not true.
Yes.
That's not what Port Landy has taught me. That's what all of us East Coasters know all about Oregon. By the way, that
show sucks.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. I'm glad
Cultural segment. Cultural segment of the show. That show is terrible.
Yeah, before we get into the sports, let's just talk about how extremely overrated Port Landy is. It's not funny.
Does anyone like it? Does anyone?
Yes, people love it. White people love that show. I don't get it.
I feel like the people who love it are... Like, that's why we can say that it's not overrated. We know that whatever those people like, no one else should have any respect for. And so as a result, we can say with certainty that it's an awful show.
That's probably true. Most of the people I know who like it, like,
I say it with quite a bit of certainty. It is an awful show, and I say it with quite a good deal of certainty.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yes. I like Fred Armisen for what he's done on SNL, but, like, I don't know. That's not...
He's okay. He's not that great. Let's be serious.
That's true. He's definitely not the greatest. I mean, I'll take Bill Hader any day of the week, but anyway. We'll save that for our SNL podcast. What?
I thought his impression of, I believe it was the blind mayor of New York City for...
David Patterson.
He was the mayor for a brief period. Yes, that was actually hilarious. He took a ton of heat for it, but that was the funniest thing ever.
No, it was great. It was like, you know...
I haven't seen that, but that sounds good.
It was like Ray Charles in the government. It was excellent.
David Patterson, SNL, is really funny.
Yeah, look it up. See, that's a sketch worth watching, Port Landy and Not So Much. All right, guys, let's get into the sports now. We have a lot to talk this week. We're going to talk about a certain New England Patriots tight end that just had an eatsy-weensy little bit of trouble, and we're going to give you our all-star ballots, who we would vote for in the MLB All-Star game this year. But first, Raphael, the NBA. We were looking for a Game 7 in this year's finals, and we got one. It certainly didn't disappoint. We're going to do a little bit of the season wrap-up here, talk about the finals, the last two games, Game 6 and Game 7. And then we're probably going to take a break for a little while so Owen can talk about sports he cares about. So let's do a little bit of a deep dive here into the finals. Let's start chronologically. Of course, everybody knows the Heat win the NBA Finals. They are NBA championship, NBA champions. LeBron gets the back-to-back, and they will go for the three-peat next year, which will put them in company only with Los Angeles Lakers and the Chicago Bulls. Potentially the Boston Celtics as well. I'm not sure if they won or not. But if they did, they would only be the fourth team to win back-to-back-to-back NBA championships. Obviously very impressive. LeBron further cements his legacy, continues to push himself into the conversation for greatest player ever. But let's go back for a second, because Game 6 could be worth a podcast all on its own. I don't know about you, Raphael, but that was the greatest game I think I can remember in my lifetime. Certainly as being a mature NBA fan, it's the greatest game I've ever seen. So let's start there. What was your impressions of that Game 6 huge Heat comeback to push it to a Game 7?
Well, I mean, so going into the fourth quarter, I thought the game was over. I mean, we were texting back and forth. We both thought, okay, the Spurs have won this series. there's no way the Heat can come back from this. And what's going to happen next year? We're talking about, like, getting rid of Chris Bosh, like, what they should try to get for Chris Bosh, what they should do with Dwayne Wade, because he's seriously underperforming. And then, oh, my God, LeBron James exploded.
Yeah,
I mean, holy shit. 16 points in the fourth quarter, just a ridiculous offensive explosion. He was just running past people, just on fire. And it was so fast. It happened so fast. And then all of a sudden they're in the game, and you think, oh, my God, what's happening? What's happening? And then he starts turning the ball over. He has a few bad turnovers. I mean, I think he's gotten more heat for those turnovers than he should have. I think that they were honestly pretty reasonable turnovers, but they were turnovers nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Spurs gain control again, and they have a 5-point lead, and then Kawhi Leonard's at the line. They have a 4-point lead, and Kawhi Leonard is at the line, and he looks nervous. I mean, he's only 21 years old, and he's, you know, shooting the two biggest free throws of his life. And he goes up there and he misses the first free throw, but then makes the second, so they have a 5-point lead. And then, like, all hell breaks loose. You've got this, like, mad dash at the end where, like, LeBron hits a 3-pointer with, I think, 28 seconds left on the clock. And then, Ray Allen obviously hit, you know, the game tying three in the corner with 5 seconds left on the clock. And that took the game to overtime.
Yeah, everybody forgets about
that. I mean, obviously, it's like, I mean, holy crap. There was no way in my mind that the Heat were going to come back. And then it looked like they were, and then they weren't, and then they did, with 5 seconds left on the clock. And then overtime was extremely tight, too. But they pulled that out. I honestly, like, I think it was a good no-call on Manu Ginobili there. I think that, like, given the way the refs have been calling the game, I don't think that that was a foul, given that, like...
No, it was a travel, anyways.
There have been so many more calls. Yeah, I mean, Manu Ginobili basically travels every time he has the ball. I don't know how he gets away with it. But, yeah, the way that the refs were calling that game, I just don't think that was a foul. I don't think that would have been right to call a foul like that with that little time left on the clock. I thought that ultimately that game ended the way it should have. But, I mean, it was one of the greatest, like, games of any sport that I've ever watched, not just basketball. It was the best basketball game I've ever watched, but it was one of the most exciting sporting events I've ever seen.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, before going into the series, I predicted the Heat in 7. Obviously, that's what it came out with. But I was with you. Going into the fourth quarter, I thought it was over. The Spurs had won that game. It looked like the better team for the prior three quarters. And then LeBron just exploded. I mean, you can say he's not clutch all you want. You can point to times earlier in his career. But the dude is just, when it really comes down to the wire, with the exception of that final series in Dallas, he played incredible. A coworker of mine sent me these stats. So LeBron famously lost his headband in the fourth quarter of that game 6, which kind of roughly coincided with his explosion as well. So these stats with the headband for LeBron, this is pretty much the first three quarters, 36 minutes, 20 points, 7 rebounds, 9 assists, 2 steals, and no block. And then in the fourth quarter in overtime, basically a quarter and a half, 14 minutes, 12 points, 3 rebounds, 2 assists, 1 steal, and 1 block. I mean, he just took the game over and won it for them. And then, you know, everybody liked to talk about the Spurs missed free throws and then Duncan not being in the game for that offensive rebound at the end, which Chris Bosh got and was able to pass to Ray Allen for that corner three to send it to overtime. But I don't really put that much stock into it. He missed free throws earlier in the game. LeBron turned the ball over twice. You know, you can't put too much stock on, I mean, free throws can win and lose games. There's a reason why DeAndre Jordan and Blake Griffin never play late in the fourth quarter for the Clippers because they can't hit free throws, but I mean, it's just things that happen. I don't know if you can say that they wilted. I don't necessarily agree that Kawhi Leonard was nervous at the line. It's just one of those things that happened. The Heat were just better down the stretch, and that's why they
happened. But he also, he did look nervous. He looked nervous
at
the line.
But he played like a
man.
I mean, he was the only, but he was the only Spur to score a point in overtime. I mean, can you...
No, you're absolutely right. He played great in overtime, but I don't think that that means it's impossible that he was nervous there at the line with just a few seconds left in that game.
Sure, but I wouldn't put the blame on him for missing that free throw.
No, God, no. I mean, are you kidding? I'm not blaming Kawhi Leonard for that loss. Okay. Kawhi Leonard was, like, probably the best player on that team. If they had won that series, I think Kawhi Leonard deserved to be NBA Finals and MVP.
Overall, I agree with you, but Duncan was a monster in those last two games. Like, he looked like 2003.
He was a monster, but, like, I think that just, like, having, like, without Kawhi Leonard, they would not have been in the position they were. That guy came in, he played monster defense.
Yep.
He's an up-and-coming, if not superstar, like, very, very, very good player. you know, without Kawhi Leonard, that's a very different series. And no one was talking about Kawhi Leonard going into the series.
Yeah. No, totally.
No, I'm not like trying to put any blame on him. Not at all. But I think he was a little nervous taking that free throw.
I mean, that's probably true. Yeah. And I think we just need to make a distinction there to say he's nervous versus, you know, he choked or whatever like that. Because again, only Spurs to score a point in overtime.
No, he didn't choke. He did not choke.
Right. No, that's fair. Just as long as you're telling that distinction there. So, as you mentioned, it goes to overtime and the Heat pull out that game. Just an amazing game for, it's hard to say, to put it into words in hindsight, but the feeling of it just literally being over. Like, I mean, you know, the Heat fans left halfway through. If I was going to leave as a Heat fan, I would have left in the fourth quarter because the Spurs just don't give up games like that down the stretch. They execute well, and they just did. LeBron just took the game over. It was the best player in the world can do. So, you know, amazing game. We think that maybe the Spurs are going to have a letdown game 7. It's such an emotional loss because they had that game locked up. They probably should have won it despite LeBron's heroics. But Game 7 was a close game again, back and forth all the way to the end. Give me your impressions of how you thought Game 7 went.
Well, honestly, I thought that the Heat should have been winning Game 7 by a lot more. But it seemed like every time they tried to pull away, the Spurs would kind of make a huge shot. And again, Kawhi Leonard made a couple really big shots, which really kept them in the game. He made a huge three-point play with that crazy behind-the-back layup. I mean, every time they were about to pull away, it seemed like they either faltered a little bit, maybe got a little bit cold shooting, or the Spurs really roped them in with some really great shooting. So, I mean, it was a really exciting game. It was back and forth. The Heat basically led for the whole game, but by, like, 4 points. I mean, it was never, like, a very comfortable lead. And then, obviously, way down the stretch, things got really close. Tim Duncan missed that easy little layup, and then the putback. So, you know, people kind of putting some blame for that, for the loss on him. Obviously, if he'd made that shot, which I think Shane Battier said that he probably would have made 8 out of 10 times, you know, maybe a different game, maybe not.
Yeah, but I mean, if Tim Duncan doesn't play, Tim Duncan doesn't play the way he does up until that point, I don't think they're nearly that close. Again, he had an amazing game in that last, you know, for him to put up a box score like that, like that's just something a 37-year-old shouldn't be able to do. It's crazy that he was doing.
Also, he played huge minutes in Game 6,
yeah,
and then huge minutes in the game again in Game 7.
Yeah, it was. I mean, him and Ray Allen were amongst the
minutes
leaders.
It was very impressive
leaders.
Performance.
Yeah, you can talk about young blood all you want.
Definitely
with
impressive
Warriors
the old guys
and the Nuggets, but yeah, it's the old guys really stole the show there. So, I mean, I kind of agree with you. I thought the Heat probably should have been leading by more. It really didn't ever feel to me like they were in danger of losing, despite the Spurs' late run there. For most of
I very much disagree. The fact that they just could not put away the Spurs, I mean, obviously they were a tip in away from tying that game with very little time left on the clock. I disagree. I did feel like the Heat could have lost that game.
I feel like they could have lost that game, but I felt like they were the better team throughout that game. I guess I should.
No, yeah, but the better team really sometimes loses. Especially in a Game 7.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, one game can anything can happen in one game. Especially when one of your so-called big three scores 0 points. This gets overshadowed by LeBron hitting that long jumper to seal the deal. You know, polishing his jump shot, which is the last game that could get any criticism whatsoever. I think that kind of takes the spotlight with him when he was
MVP. Argument is over. That argument is totally over. People like Skip Bayless, who sucks, but Skip Bayless saying, like, well, LeBron James doesn't have the clutch gene. He can't hit the big jump shot in the big moment. Well, you know what? He did. He did it again and again and again. He did it in Game 6 when he hit the 3, and then he did it in Game 7 with that, like, 20-foot jump shot with 20 seconds left on the clock to really put the dagger in the game.
Yep.
I mean, he was seriously clutch with the jump shot. He went 5 for 10 from 3 in that game. He really shot the Spurs to death. So,
I loved LeBron's game in that Game 7. They were giving him those open jumpers, and he was feeling it, and he was like, you know what, if you're giving me this, I'm going to shoot it. That's exactly what he should have done, especially taking all those threes. Statistically, that's the best way you can go, and if they're open, which they were, you should take them. I mean, one of the first threes he took there was wide open, and I was screaming at the TV, shoot it, shoot it, shoot it, because that's what he should do. He's a good enough three-point shooter, and he sunk it, and he made the Spurs pay for it. I love that. I also love in his post-game speech, I think it was Doris Burke asked him, you know, when you're making those jump shots, are you unstoppable? He was like, yeah, I am. I love that. I mean, maybe some people look at it as hubris or
Well, he is.
Bragging,
you know, it's not
true.
Overconfident because it's true.
Yeah, It is true. I mean,
if he's making that jump shot, if he's hitting from three, if he's hitting 50% from three, he is unstoppable.
Yeah.
Because you know what? He's either if you got to choose one, either you're going to make him shoot or you're going to let him get past you, and he can beat you both ways now. And if he's hitting the shots, he's unstoppable.
Yeah, I mean, the Spurs are a very smart defensive team, and they're going to make the best player go to his weakness, and that's what they did with his jump shot. But he proved it wasn't a weakness in that game, and he was unstoppable and led the Heat to a victory. I mentioned it briefly.
Let's return to Chris Bosh.
Yeah, though. Let's talk about him for a second. Chris Bosh, 0 points in Game 7 of the NBA Finals. Rafael, I'll ask you, was Chris Bosh a liability on the floor for the Heat?
Well, he made a few big defensive stops, big defensive plays, and he didn't take that many shots. So, given that he didn't shoot that much, the fact that he had no points isn't that surprising, because, I mean, Wade and LeBron were both feeling it. So he wasn't a huge liability, but obviously the fact that he had no points and he's one of the big three is very troubling. These were not his best playoffs. He had moments where he performed pretty well, but in general, I mean, you look at that Indiana series, and that really exploited some of his biggest weaknesses. And to a lesser degree, the Spurs did it as well. You got to worry about Chris Bosh looking forward, and maybe whether he really fits in well with this team's future. I have serious doubts about that, even with the Heat actually winning this series.
You know, for me, it's interesting. I mean, I've been, along with you, one of the bigger critics of Chris Bosh, but in hindsight, the 0 points doesn't bother me as much as it did at the time. Obviously, the Heat won the game, so it wasn't like they were missing a huge contribution from Bosh, although Shane Battier stepped up with 6 of 8 from downtown. Obviously, that helps. But I think Bosh, in a way, is kind of the best-case scenario for the Heat in terms of a big guy who doesn't need a lot of touches. He's not going to complain like, I don't know, Dwight Howard will if he doesn't get the ball every other possession.
That's true. He's not selfish.
Yeah, and you have to wonder for me. I mean, he was guarding Duncan and Splitter and at times Kawhi Leonard, obviously very big, physical big men for a lot of the series. And I wonder if that kind of took him out of his offensive game, because he was really good on the defensive end. I mean, despite Tim going nuts, it wasn't like Bosh was playing him poorly. Tim Duncan was just...
Yeah, there's only so much you can do.
Exactly. So I don't place that on Bosh at all, and his help defense was really good throughout the series. He's the fastest center in the league, probably because he's not really a center. He's more of a power forward. But he fits really well with the Heat's athletic style, and when he's hitting that jumper, he wasn't in Game 7, but when he is, he can space the floor, which LeBron helps open up driving lanes for LeBron and for Wade, who at this point in his career seems like all he can do is drive in the lane and hit those mid-range jumpers. So, I don't know, it didn't bother me that much that for the 0 points, because he was expending so much energy on defense, and you never know how much of his energy expended on defense hurt his offensive game. And for, you know, if I'm going to pick the two contributions between him, I'd rather have him step up on defense than, you know, get a 20-point game, because we can always get that from LeBron. But
that's
of the
true.
Big three, despite Dwayne Wade having kind of a good Game 7, I would try to get rid of Dwayne Wade. I don't think it's actually going to happen. He's the face of the Miami franchise, led them to their first title. He's been a superstar in the league for a long time, brought LeBron and Bosh to Miami. So I don't think that he actually will trade him, but I think they should. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, he's not getting any younger. It seems like every year at the end of the season there's some kind of injury issue. Which obviously is not good. I mean, he was injured to some degree last year too, injured pretty seriously, frankly, this entire postseason. But you got to give him credit for playing through that. But still, I mean, he was not really himself at any point during these playoffs until really the end. I don't know. I mean, the thing I like about Wade is that you got two guys in LeBron James and Dwayne Wade that can like attack very, very well. And when they're both attacking well, that's why I'm a Heat fan. It's because they play the most exciting brand of basketball to watch in the NBA. So if they got rid of Wade, they might not. I don't know. I really like their fast athletic pace, as you mentioned, and I think Wade actually does contribute a lot to that.
I wouldn't judge
him too much by his performance at the end of the season, because I mean he had a deep bone bruise in his knee. Frankly, I'm amazed he was playing as well as he was. That's a very serious injury, or it's a very painful injury, especially for an extremely athletic player like Wade. So I don't know. I actually don't think I would trade Dwayne Wade, even if he is getting older. yeah, it's, I don't even think, I don't think it's a good idea, even if you could do it.
Yeah, I agree with you that when he's healthy, he is, you know, a dynamic attacker of the rim, one of the best finishers at the rim as well. But he's just getting older. He's, I don't think he's ever going to be, except for maybe at the beginning of the season, in tip-top shape. He's, at the end of the season now, he's always dinged up. He's always got something going on with his knees. He's just, I don't think he's ever going to be the same player throughout the entire series ever again. And I think it's just going to get worse. I mean, the Dwayne Wade in Game 7 was not that attacking Wade. He just happened to hit all those mid-range jumpers. He could take one or two steps toward the rim, and then he would just have to pull up, because the Spurs were right to play 5 feet off of them. And, you know, fortunately for him, those shots were falling, but he's not a great jump shooter. His game really is driving to the rim, and long-term, I just don't see him being able to do that. But credit to him, on defense, again, kind of like Bosch, he's really, really good on defense. It's an underrated aspect of his game, but he fits really well with what Miami does defensively. He's an excellent help defender. His rotations are really, really good. I don't think he gets enough credit for that, and didn't get enough credit for that in the series. So, you know, gotta give ups to him for that. Even when he wasn't playing well offensively, his defense still was very good and helped keep the Heat in it at least a little bit. But long-term, I have serious concerns for him. But let's talk about the Heat in general and the Spurs for next year. Do you see either of these teams getting back to the NBA Finals next year?
I mean, I think the Heat absolutely can. I would say, I'll start with the Spurs. No. I think this was like the last great run of the Spurs, and I really think there's virtually no chance that they get back to the finals next year. He should. He's not that good anymore. Yeah. Let's be serious. Manu Ginobili is not getting any better. He's an old 35, and like, you know, 35 is old, so for him to be an old 35 is not good. He's not the player he used to be. He should just retire now, sit on his like three or four championships and just say, you know, I'm going to have fun at the Hall of Fame. He has nothing left to prove at this point, and I think he should just hang him up. Tim Duncan, you know, he's going to be 38 next season. I just don't see them putting together a run like this anytime soon. I mean, Kawhi Leonard, I think, is going to be a very, very good player if he keeps improving. He's still very young. But no, I don't see them getting back to the finals. I think the Heat have a much better chance, but I mean, no one's a guarantee to the finals. The Heat had to go through a game 7 against the Pacers. They had some very tough playoff series the year before that. No, there's no guarantee, but the Heat obviously have got to be one of the favorites to make the finals.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on both points, especially about the Spurs. I think Ginobili is, if he's not done, he's pretty close to it. I think he's probably what I envisioned Dwayne Wade being in, you know, a couple of years at this point. Just a little bit washed up, except for that one really good game, was it game 5? Against Miami. He had done nothing. And then he played pretty well in game 7 against the Heat, but still not the Manu Ginobili of old. I just, with further decline from Ginobili, another year of age on Tim Duncan's shoulders, I think I agree with you. I see some decline for the Spurs, and I don't see them being able to get back to the NBA Finals, especially with hopefully a healthy Thunder next year. Continued improvement from the Rockets, who knows what they're going to do in free agency. And then the Clippers, looks like they'll be a contender as well. As for the Heat, I don't see them getting back to the NBA Finals next year. I think they can. Obviously, they have the talent. They're the best player in the world, and I hope they do, because I'd love to see LeBron three-peat, but they've played, as a team, so many minutes over the past years. They've been to the finals 3 years in a row. That's like a whole nother quarter season added to your schedule just by playing in the playoffs and getting to the finals, plus LeBron playing in the Olympics. I mean, I just think they're at some point they're going to wear down. And continued improvement from the Bulls with Rose getting back, and I think the Pacers are going to take another step forward. I agree with you, the Heat have to be the favorites because they've done it 3 years in a row now and they have the best player in the world, but I don't know. They're not very heavy favorites to me, and I could easily see the Pacers Bulls representing the Eastern.
They're not heavy favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think either the Bulls or the Pacers could pull the, at this point, not a huge upset, but like it's still an upset. No, I think you're absolutely right. The East is very strong. You've got some very good teams up top that can really compete with the Heat. But yeah, I still think they're like a slight favorite.
Yeah. I mean, they have to be because, again, best player in the world. But one thing to note, too, is even MJ's Bulls, they never got to the finals 3 years consecutively. They did it 3 years consecutively twice, but there was that, you know, weird 96 year in between when MJ went off to play baseball and, you know, got suspended for gambling and all that sort of stuff. But You know, even when they had what I think everybody would say is the best player in the world, still weren't able to do it 4 years in a row. So it's tough. You know, a lot of extra minutes on those shoulders.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right, briefly, let's talk about some other NBA news because it is just very recent. Doc Rivers goes from is released by the Celtics from his contract to coach them, goes to the Clippers in exchange for a first-round pick. That's the Celtics' condition for letting Doc go of his contract. He will now apparently be the Clippers' coach, is going to sign another five-year deal worth about $35 million to be their coach. So is this enough for the Celtics to give up? Is this enough? Did the Celtics get enough back, rather, to let Doc Rivers go? And is this a good deal for the Clippers? Does this push them into finals contention, assuming they can re-sign CP3?
Well, I would say first, no, this isn't enough for Doc Rivers. Doc Rivers, I think, has established himself as one of the elite coaches in the league. And just a first-round pick is frankly not that much, especially from, like, the Clippers, because they're going to be good, so it's not going to be, like, a lottery pick. No, I don't think it's not nearly enough. They're going to get kind of like a mediocre player out of it, probably, for Doc Rivers. Yeah, I think the Clippers definitely won that. But does it make them a contender? Yes, it does make them a contender. they had really good. They should have been a contender this year. They have some really great pieces there. They have a team that I think works very well. And now they have one of the best coaches in the league. So absolutely, they're a contender.
Yeah, I think first on the Clippers end of it, I agree with you. I think this is a great move for the Clippers. It's obviously a huge upgrade from Vinny Del fucking Negro to Doc Rivers. Pretty much the biggest upgrade you could possibly get in terms of getting a new coach. I agree with you. Doc Rivers is the top five coach in the league, just barely below Popovich and Tom Thibodeau. Those are probably the only two I'd put ahead of him. Eric Spoelstra, by the way, just to give him a little bit of props, has put himself up there as a top coach.
Yeah, top five coach right there.
Had a really good playoff start as well, but. And I think this helps attract free agents to the Clippers. I think this will pretty much guarantee CP3 comes back. And it'll help ease over some of the tension that was reported between CP3 and Blake Griffin. But one thing to note on Doc, he's not really known as a coach who is very good at developing young players, which is a little bit concerning because if the Clippers are really to become an elite team, they need Blake and DeAndre to take a bigger step forward, or to take a big step forward and become, I mean, Blake is probably already a superstar, but he needs a little bit of work on his defense. He needs to work on his offensive game as well to get a little bit more varied in what he does offensively. DeAndre, looks like the Clippers are going to try and trade him to the Celtics for Kevin Garnett. David Stern might not have any of that. It's a longer discussion than we need to have here, so it's unclear what's going to happen there. But maybe a little bit of concern if you're the Clippers. But again, you would trade a low first-round pick for to get Doc Rivers and replace, you know, Vinny Del Negro with him. It's a huge upward move for them. But I disagree with you that the Celtics didn't get enough in return. First of all, they would have to pay Doc Rivers $21 million over the next 3 years to coach a team that's frankly not going to be very good. Even if they kept Rajon Rondo, Paul Pierce, and Kevin Garnett, that's not going to be a championship caliber team. I'm sorry, it's just not. That's not what the Celtics want to keep around anyways. They want to rebuild. So why are you going to pay a coach $7 million a year to help you rebuild? It doesn't matter if you have Vinny Del Negro or, well, that's a bad example, but if you can get a $1 million coach and still go through a couple years of rebuilding as you gain assets on your roster. So I think even though it's a good point that this is going to be a low pick, it's not going to be a lottery pick. Still, to get anything for a coach and to save a whole bunch of money in the process, I think it's probably a pretty good deal for the Celtics, and I think they're ultimately pretty happy with it to, you know, not have to pay Doc Rivers $21 million to coach a 21 team.
Yeah, that's a fair point, I guess. It's hard to give up a coach like Doc Rivers. I mean, someone like that doesn't just come around every once in a while. If you have a great coach, I mean, I tend to think that, I don't know, you may be right.
Yeah,
to let go a coach like of his caliber for just one kind of shitty pick.
Sure, but like 5 years from now would be a reasonable timeline for the Celtics to be good again, right? By the time they draft and develop new players. So why can't Doc just come back to the Celtics after 5 years of the Clippers? They'd probably welcome them back, right? So, I don't know. Something to consider, at least there. All right, Owen has been sitting patiently in the sidelines. We've talked about the NBA. We will not talk nearly about it as much going forward. We'll probably do a little bit of news and notes as free agent signings happen, but that's a while down the road. Let's bring Owen back in now to talk about the NFL. We don't like to talk about the Patriots too much because, of course, they are an overrated, overhyped team. But we will make an exception for Mr. Aaron Hernandez. Owen, I want to ask you, on a scale of leave room for Jesus to Amy Lee Raped, how fucked is Aaron Hernandez?
I'm not sure we know yet. It sounds like he's not necessarily under investigation.
He's under investigation.
Come on. You got his house searched?
No, his house searched?
Like, he's pretty clearly
Under investigation.
The cop said that he wasn't a suspect when they were searching his house, which is odd. Like, they could just say no comment, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know how much I buy that.
I mean, it looks bad. And he'll probably miss some time one way or another because it makes the NFL look bad. Nevertheless, I'm not totally convinced that he's actually a suspect in a murder right now.
I mean, the problem with Aaron Hernandez's situation is that, you know, he may not be officially named a suspect yet, but he's very clearly under investigation. I think they've made that pretty clear. I mean, they're searching around. There seems to be some kind of tie between him and the victim, which doesn't look good. He was with the victim, I think it was supposedly a few hours. They can tie him to the victim a few hours before they believe the victim was killed. And I don't understand exactly what this is with the civil suit, but is someone else also suing Aaron Hernandez for shooting them in the face?
Yeah, there was. Yeah, so this is a separate incident. It was back in February. It was, like, in Miami. Apparently, they had an argument. He's, like, fleeing the scene or driving away, turned around to shoot somebody who was following him. I don't know. Very unclear.
Yeah, I didn't know if it was that or if they were both, like, they were playing with a gun, basically, and he shot the guy in the face. If he shot the guy in the face on purpose, then he would probably be in jail. It wouldn't just be a civil suit.
Yeah.
I don't think you could even win a civil suit without filing a criminal complaint.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, why didn't you file a criminal complaint if he tried to kill you and then he shot you in the face? So I think that one was an accident, and they were both, like, in on it or something.
Yeah, I'm confused. I don't really know nearly enough about it, but it's just a lot of bad things going on in Aaron Hernandez's life right now. I'm not convinced. I mean, he was he not already charged with obstruction of justice?
In relation to this?
He was. I didn't hear that.
I thought he'd already been charged with obstruction, yeah.
As far as I know, he hasn't been charged with anything, although, I mean, when you're, like, this deep in the shit, I don't like to speculate on players. I like to maintain Ryan Braun's innocence. But, like, when you have cops around, like, searching the pond near your house, and, like, you destroy your security system of your house and hire a cleaning crew to scrub your house down, like, I don't know. It's pretty clear he's done something. I don't know if he murdered somebody or if you pulled a Ray Lewis and was just an accessory to whatever happened, but
yeah, it really looked bad. It looks really, really bad for Aaron Hernandez.
Yeah. Apparently,
so the real question is, how does this affect Tim Tebow?
Yeah, that's a fair question. Do you think Tim Tebow has a legitimate chance to play tight end, Owen?
I mean, at this point, he's about the same size as Hernandez, and you've got nobody else. I think they picked up, like, Dustin Keller from the Bears, or, you know, I don't know. It's a bad situation, no doubt about it. When you're picking up former Bears tight ends, then you know you're in trouble. It wasn't just the Dustin Keller, although maybe they got him too. I don't know. Anyway, we're going to see some people playing tight end for the Patriots who we've never heard of before next year, and that's going to be a surprise given the way their offense has operated the past 2-3 seasons.
Do you think they will actually get Tebow to play tight end? Do you think he would do it?
I think that they'll use a different set. I don't think they're going to run the same way they were running last year, because they can't do that without Gronkowski and Hernandez. It wasn't even as effective with just one of those guys last year.
Yep.
I think whatever they're going to do, they're going to change their set, and they might, you know, if you look at the way sort of San Francisco was running this two tight end set, they were actually using their fullback, Delanie Walker, and actually lining him up, you know, sort of more, they were lining him up in the backfield and then having him shift out to the line. But they still had, besides that, they still had six guys in the line. So, I don't know, we'll see what they do exactly, but it won't be the same. And Tebow, if he's a tight end, he'll be a pseudo tight end, where he's in the backfield to start so that there's a possibility he take the snap to keep defenses off balance.
Yeah. Let's assume that Hernandez is not on the Patriots next year, whether this something comes to fruition and he gets arrested or suspended or the Patriots just decide that they don't want to deal with this headache anymore. It's too much of a media distraction. They don't want him in the locker room. They've got kind of a squeaky clean reputation. So they cut him or they trade him or whatever. How good are the Patriots next year? Rob Gronkowski looks like he's going to be on the pup list to start the season. They don't really have anything at wide receiver other than Danny Amendola. Can the Patriots win with just Tom Brady, Stephen Ridley, and maybe healthy Danny Amendola?
Yes, I think they can. Haven't they done that before? Tom Brady doesn't need good receivers. He just needs people who stand there and can catch the ball if it's thrown somewhere near them.
Yeah,
and if
he
that's
needs
what,
warm
I mean,
bodies. I don't know if he even has those at this point.
Well, you know, they'll find some people on the street then, put them in pads, and throw them on the field, and have Tom Brady throw it at them. They'll be okay. I don't think they're a title contender, but, I mean, they'll probably make the playoffs anyway.
Yeah, I mean, just look what they did with Ridley. The fact that you mentioned Ridley's name just goes to show you that they'll figure something out. Ridley is frankly not that good, but they're using the pass to set up the run in that offense. I mean, Ridley was a no-name going into it. Second round in the draft, he was out of LSU. There were a lot of questions about his, you know, ball security. And now he's, like, certainly one of the top running backs. Everybody knows he's going to be the starter. If you just put people around, like you say, warm bodies, if you put warm bodies around Tom Brady, he's going to figure it out. They maybe won't be as good as last year, but they'll still be very good. Just, you know, like last year, even after losing Gronkowski, they played very well. So I still expect to see them in the playoffs, but I agree that at this point, you certainly can't put them in the Super Bowl, or maybe even the AFC Championship.
Okay, guys, let's transition to the MLB now and talk about our mock All-Star ballots. We did this just before the show, actually. Went through the MLB All-Star ballot. We're doing this a little bit differently from the official All-Star ballot. We're not filling out a full team, and we're not just doing offense, which is all you can do if you vote on MLB.com or at the ballpark. So what we're going to do is we're going to give a position player for each of the positions. We're just going to do regular outfield. We're not going to break it down by left fielder, center fielder, or right fielder. So three outfielders, first baseman, second baseman, shortstop, third baseman, catcher. And then we're doing, what is this, five pitchers that we decided on? Yeah, five pitchers, and then Owen's going to give us some guys that were just on the bubble for him. So I'm just going to go through real quick and we'll do it position by position, and I'll discuss what we each have here for the AL and the NL. So first base, Owen has Chris Davis in the AL, Paul Goldschmidt in the NL, Rafael is the same thing, and then for me in the for first baseman, I have Chris Davis also in the AL and Joey Votto in the NL. So why don't you guys give me your perspective? Why do you have Goldschmidt over Joey Votto?
Because the dude's a hitting machine. He's just extremely good. He's hitting for really good average and really good power. I mean, it's just awesome. Batting over 300 with 19 home runs.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big comparison here, it's they're both obviously very good, and I think Votto deserves to be in the All-Star game. I just think that Goldschmidt deserves to be the starter because the trade from Votto to Goldschmidt, you're trading power for on-base percentage. And, you know, in this case, I'll take the power, right? I mean, when we talk about on-base percentage as a skill in baseball, there are certain – that's great and all, but you still need a player who can hit some home runs. And so when you have a high on-base percentage player, that tends to be valuable at a position that's not first base, where the average across baseball – I mean, look at some of the guys coming into this year, like Mitch Moreland wasn't a starter last year, not a big name. The guy's got 12, 13 home runs. There's so much power to go around at this position, and Joey Votto playing in that stadium ought to be hitting more home runs. I think he's trading walks for home runs, and I'm not sure that's actually a good trade.
I think
the Reds would prefer that he was that.
Go ahead, finish your point.
I think the Reds would prefer that. I mean, you look at he's walking some absurd proportion of the time, and he's getting on base like crazy, but. And if he starts chasing more pitches and he walks less, maybe he strikes out more and his average comes down a little bit. His on-base percentage would certainly come down. But if he hits, you know, seven or eight more home runs in that time, maybe that's worth it.
It's interesting you mentioned the number of home runs. For me, the difference in home runs, and we'll just put the numbers out there, Paul Goldschmidt with 19 home runs, Joey Votto with 13 home runs. So it's not like it's a huge drop-off in power between the two of them. Six home runs.
Votto plays in the most generous home run stadium in baseball. Not that Arizona's Like,
well, I mean, I don't know. I'd have to look Cincinnati at the park factors to see. It's a good home run, Steve. They're both hitters parks.
It's the easiest place to hit a home run in baseball.
Also, you've talked about Yankee Stadium.
At a high school stadium smaller than that, bigger than that.
Yankee Stadium, come on. We've talked about this all year. That's the easiest place to hit a home run. You can throw a ball.
Yankee Stadium is big to center field, though.
I guess. I mean,
down the line, but then it's 408 to center. Whereas if you're like Cincinnati, you're small to all fields.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't know. For the park factors for me, it's not as big of a difference to say that Joey Votto should automatically have six more home runs just because he's playing in Great American Ballpark. But I mean, the climate too in Arizona is very favorable. Anyway, but the point I wanted to bring up on the power there is because power is so available at first base, that puts less of a premium on it for me because you can find it so cheaply. Whereas, you know, I would rather trade the six home runs that Joey Votto is giving up for the 60 points in OBP that you gain with Joey Votto. That for me is just a huge, huge gain. He's leading the league in on-base percentage. It's not like Paul Goldschmidt's bad. 384 OBP is very, very good. But Joey Votto's 440 OBP, I mean, I'll take the guy who's on base almost half the time, even if he's not hitting the ball quite as far when he actually does make contact. But to me, that's just... That is the difference in value, is just the amount of times you're putting your team into position to drive you home is so much greater with Joey Votto than it is with Paul Goldschmidt, that's what puts him over the top of me. But Paul Goldschmidt is no slouch at all. I think he should be in the All-Star game, but for me, if I'm picking a starter at first base in the NL, it's gonna be Joey Votto. Again, Goldschmidt deserving, but not quite as much for me. I understand the power argument, though.
One quick thing. Is how they're being used maybe should be talked about. If Joey Votto were batting second, he might be a lot better because he might score a lot more runs. But Dusty Baker continues to hit him third when I don't think that he has as much value there as he does close to the top of the order. You look at Goldschmidt, and he's been batting behind a very productive top of the order, and as a result, he's driven in a ton of runs. And so I think in that regard, if you're batting behind a bunch of guys who have a high on-base percentage, then you might want to trade some of your on-base percentage for power. And maybe that's what he's doing. And, you know, you can't argue with the RBI numbers. And while that's a product of opportunity, it's also a product of taking advantage of the opportunity. And I think that Goldschmidt has just been so great at doing that we have to give him that starting role.
I mean, yeah, Joey Votto is betting.
He's younger, which is more exciting.
I don't think you can say that Joey Votto is not taking advantage of the opportunity when, you know, fucking Dusty Baker is batting Zach Cozart second, and Zach Cozart is sub-300 OBP. You don't have guys...
Right, no, I mean, I'm arguing that Votto hasn't really had the opportunity to perform in his optimal role, which might be more as a run scorer than a run producer.
Yeah, that might be fair. I mean, I don't think he's the fastest guy on the planet anyways, but it's a good point. It's something worth considering. I don't like to talk about RBIs because, as you mentioned, they are entirely a function of opportunity, and not really descriptive of a guy's skill at all. So, anyway. Let's move on to our second base position. I was remarking as filling this out, particularly in the NL, it's pretty weak as who was the second baseman there. So there was the obvious candidate, Matt Carpenter for the St. Louis Cardinals, having a great year, far and away above anybody else in the NL for second base. I really wanted to vote Chase Utley, but he doesn't have quite the offensive numbers and he's missed a lot of time. So couldn't quite do that there. We do have a lot of disagreement for AL second baseman, though. Owen has Jason Kipnis, I have Robbie Cano, and Rafael is Dustin Pedroia. Rafael, I know you're in Boston, but what's with all the Red Sox love?
Well, I just like that. I mean, first of all, Pedroia's, you know, he's got the fantasy team boost, so I'll give him credit for that. But also, you know, he's got the guy high batting average. He's batting .311, very excellent OBP. He's on base 39.4% of the time, which is great. You know, obviously, RBI is a product of opportunity, but 41 RBIs is pretty good. And I like that he's stealing some bases, too. He's got 10 stolen bases. So he's kind of doing it in every way you want, except he's not hitting for a ton of power. That's the only real knock on him right now is only 4 home runs. But, I mean, he could pick that up. He's averaged in the past between, like, 15 and 18 home runs. So, you know, I think he could turn up the power a little bit as the season goes on. So... Yeah, I'd give it to him just because I really like the batting average and the extremely high OBP, as well as some steals.
Owen, what's your thoughts on Kipnis?
Yeah, I mean, for one, I'll say that I would never advocate voting for any player from Boston or New York because they get enough votes as it is. And
yeah,
so
really.
it's silly to talk about that. The other thing is that I would say, you know, they both play in extreme hitters' parks in an extreme hitters' division. They get to play games in Toronto and Baltimore. Kipnis has to play games in Minnesota, and he also has to play games in Kansas City, and Cleveland isn't, like, much of a hitter's park to begin with. So I go with Kipnis here. I like, you know, his numbers are comparable, right? He's got 9 home runs, 846 OPS. He's got a 360 OBP. He's stolen 17 bases, which is amazing because he doesn't even look very fast. Anyway, yeah, I got to give it to Kipnis out of Cleveland. Just hope that people don't ever vote for anyone from Boston or New York, because they've far, you know, that time that they put, you know, they put Teixeira at first base when he was batting like 220. You know what? They don't deserve to have any more All-Stars anywhere for the rest of the century, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. It's a good point about Kipnis playing in not the most hitter-friendly parks. Obviously, Pedroia and Cano have very hitter-friendly parks as their home ballparks. To that point, OPS Plus, well, which OPS Plus, which weights OPS based on, weights it compared to league factors and adjusts for park factors. Kipnis is the highest amongst the three of these candidates. He's got a 136 OPS Plus. That means he's 36% better than league average in terms of OPS. Pedroia, 119 OPS Plus, and Robbie Cano, 129 OPS Plus. So it looks like Pedroia is pretty clearly the bottom of those three there, and Cano and Kipnis pretty close. I'll be honest, I didn't quite realize the all-around good season that Kipnis was having. 283, 359, 46 triple slash. Owen mentioned the stolen bases. 17 stolen bases. He's gone 17 for 22, so a good stolen base percentage there. But for me, I don't know if I quite believe it or not. For the All-Star game, I have two philosophies. I want legit guys there, so I don't want, you know, one-year wonders. I can't think of a good name off the top of my head, but like,
Gene Segura is a good example.
No, I believe. I don't see a second half soon coming, but that is a good example. Let's assume that Gene Segura, all the scouts agree, this is coming out of nowhere. This is not going to last. Like Didi Gregorius. Didi Gregorius was doing what he's doing for the entire series. All the scouts don't believe in the bat. So I don't want a guy like that who's going to just fall apart next year, because I want the All-Star game to accurately reflect the stars in baseball. I also want young players, or at least players who are going to be around for a long time. I don't want to give the career achievement award. Derek Jeter's had a great career, but he shouldn't be in the All-Star game this year because he hasn't played at all. If he played and was terrible, I wouldn't want him in either. So I guess I believe in Cano a little more than Kipnis, which is why the gap in OPS puts him there a little bit for me as well. I don't consider team achievements. That's what I want to ask you guys.
I don't know. Kipnis had a very good first half last year.
Yeah, I don't think this is a fluke. I just don't think he's cool. I don't think he's better than Robbie Cano offensively. Let me put it that way.
Well, part of that is that Robinson Cano is at that point in his career where he is about to experience what Mark Teixeira, Curtis Granderson, Johnny Damon, you go down the whole list of Yankees players. He's going to end up hitting 35 home runs and hitting 250. Just like every other one of them. That's what happens when you get in that stadium and it's so easy to pop one out to left field, you just swing for the fences every time.
That's not fair. I mean, Cano has a career 307 batting average, which is way down.
I know, but it's good.
Year,
so, but Granderson was on that track before he came to New York.
No, Granderson never quite had the same average as Cano. I think the years he did have a high average is more of a fluke. So I don't think it's fair to label Cano as slumping into the power numbers. And he's not far off his power pace from prior years before. I think he's just probably gotten a little bit unlucky looking for the BABIP. I don't have it quite in front of me. But I would suspect that it's lower than normal, which explains the decrease in batting average. Also, I don't like to consider lineup that much, but I think Cano is getting screwed because the Yankees lineup around him is just so terrible. He leads the league in intentional walks. He's got 10 already this year. He had 10 all of last year. So I just don't think pitchers are pitching them as much because they're not afraid that they get lineup around them. That's probably, he's not getting as many good pitches to hit. I think that probably explains some of the decline in numbers.
But in terms of this All-Star game, you'd have to say the same thing, right?
Well, they're not going to pitch around Cano if you're going to have Chris Davis behind them. So, I mean, again, Kipnis is a worthy candidate. I don't want to shit on him at all, but Pedroia, not worthy. All right, let's move to shortstop now. We all had the same candidate in the AL, J.J. Hardy. Again, kind of a dearth of good shortstops here. Rafael and I voted for Gene Segura, obviously believing in the first half here. I think he will continue it. Great power of speed and power, great combo of speed and power for me. But, Owen, you have Cabrera, and this is Everett Cabrera, I'm assuming, in the NL?
Yes.
So is this your San Diego Padres pity pick, or do you actually believe in Everett?
Cabrera in Miller Park, and he could... Oh, well, I mean, first of all, Everett's on steroids, and that's why he's having a career year. But,
I'm down with that.
I mean, you compare, like, Segura has, I think he leads all of baseball in just enough home runs.
Stuck out.
And
ball don't lie.
Yeah, I know, but Cabrera plays in Petco, and even when they moved in the fences, they haven't moved him in that far, right? You put him in Miller Park. I mean, the guy has 4 home runs, which isn't terrible for his particular position, given what else we have here. But I think you put him in Miller Park, and he could very well have 10, 11 home runs. He's got 31 stolen bases too, so that's a lot of times to turn a walk or a single into a double. I think when you consider the whole picture, Cabrera is better. He's also better in the field. He's a very good defensive shortstop. Of course, that's also possibly related to the steroids. He's a little bit quicker now. But he is on the hook for a suspension, just to clarify, with the situation that MLB is investigating right now.
Yeah. I mean, if Cabrera really had a similar power to Gene Segura, you would expect it to show up in doubles, right? Because obviously, in Petco, you're not going to hit nearly as many home runs as you would in Miller Park. But Cabrera has 4 home runs and 11 doubles. It's not like he's hitting a lot of balls that would be out in other ballparks. And again, going back to OPS Plus, which, just to reiterate, does adjust for park factors, Cabrera has a 130 OPS Plus. Obviously very good, but Gene Segura has a 141 OPS Plus. So even when adjusting for park factors, Segura has been better offensively. I hear you on the stolen bases. That's obviously phenomenal. But Gene Segura's no slouch on the base paths either. He's 23 for 25 for stolen bases. Everett Cabrera, 31 for 38. Go ahead.
I mean, don't you think their OPS pluses are sufficiently close that you ought to give the edge to the guy who plays good defense?
Well, going to the stats, I honestly have not watched much Everett Cabrera play, so I can't really back this up with the eye test. And defensive stats in the half a season of data are not very reliable, but they do support Cabrera being a little bit better than Segura, but not by a whole lot. I don't know. I just kind of believe in Gene Segura more. I know it's
because he's on your team. That's because he's on your team.
Yeah,
that's
all right, fine. He gets the fantasy boost. He gets the fantasy bump. Rafael,
the guy
has Pedroia.
Half a season.
Yeah, well,
Everett Cabrera. Even the National League in steel last year, too. If you want a guy who's for real and not a one-year wonder.
Yeah, but he had a 648 OPS last year. I mean, you know, which do you believe?
Well, I believe that Cabrera improvement is real because it's steroid-driven, but whatever.
Well, sure, I'll take the guy that doesn't have any roids in him then. I mean, I don't know. You know I don't believe in steroids anyway, so. I don't know. I think Cabrera, to me, screams fluke offensively, and so I'm going to take the guy who at least has a... who is highly rated as a prospect and is a little more valuable offensively, especially in the All-Star game. You're not watching the All-Star game for defense. Come on. Although, maybe we should. Maybe we should have a...
You were talking about defense when you were making this list.
Yes, I know. I was. Look, I'm grasping at straws here. You're making good points, all right? Shut up.
He's got the fantasy bump.
The fantasy bump. That's
fantasy
really
bump,
what it's all
it's
about.
Real. It's real.
Yeah, Rafael, back me up here. Why did you vote Segura over Cabrera?
His numbers look good. I don't know.
Numbers look pretty. Alrighty. We had
we're rounder.
Yeah. Something we can agree on is third base in both leagues. We both have David Wright in the NL and Miguel Cabrera obviously in the AL.
This was very easy.
Yeah, despite Rafael's threats to vote Manny Machado as AL third baseman, he recognized Miguel Cabrera is just having a ridiculous season.
Well, he doesn't even need the fantasy bump, dude. A while I was like, oh, man, the average is coming down. And then it went back up, you know? It was like it was down to like 358, and now it's back at 370, so.
Yeah, a mere 20 home
runs. I mean, what is going on? He's so good. He's so ridiculous.
Yeah, he's playing out of his mind.
I think he is the best player certainly since Bonds. And if you take away Bonds, like, we don't know what to attribute to the roids and what to attribute to just him. I think he's as good as Bonds in the 80s.
You know, that's a really good point. I think we all agree that, you know, even with the steroids, Bonds was the best hitter of his era. But I feel like we don't recognize Cabrera in the same pantheon as amazing hitter. Why is that?
Because we're too busy enjoying what he's doing right now to think about where he's going to stack up when he retires.
Maybe that is
too early. It's too early for Cabrera.
I mean, we all know he's a Hall of Famer. We all know, I think we can all agree that he's got to go down top 15 hitters of all time, top 10 hitters of all time. I mean, the guy's absolutely the best player in the game right now. Even if maybe not if you consider the fact that he just refuses to play a position that he can actually play.
Well, that's not his fault. Yeah.
I think he should maybe accept a DH once a week.
Well, that's
fair. I don't think it's going to hurt him.
No, that's fair. But what, are you going to put Victor Martinez at third base? Like, that's not going to work out well for the Tigers.
Oh, they would carry. I mean, they have that guy. They called him up. Castellanos. They've got him.
Yeah.
He came up as a third baseman, and right now they're trying to convert him to an outfielder because Cabrera won't move his ass.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I can't really it's hard to say. I think that's just poor roster management by the Tigers for signing Prince Fielder in the first place. Really, you should move Cabrera to first base and Fielder to DH, and I don't know. Have Victor Martinez a Viking funeral and burn him in a lake or something. I don't really know what you do with him, but yeah. I mean, Cabrera's obviously an awful defensive player, but that shouldn't take away from this hitting because it's obviously absurd. Let's go to catcher real quick. Owen and I have Joe Mauer in as our AL catcher. Raphael, you have, is this the fantasy bump here again? Is this, I'm completely forgetting
big
his first name. Carlos Santana.
Big time fantasy bump.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he's also a very good catcher. I mean, he's
Whoa, take a step back here.
No, but like, not a good
catcher. He's a terrible catcher, but you mean a good hitter who happens to play catcher.
Yeah, there's a difference.
That is correct. I think he's a good hitter. I like what he does with the bat.
Well, for me,
not Joe Mauer, but fantasy buff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to find the games played here, but I suspect that Carlos Santana has probably played more games of catcher than first baseman, but I think he's played a lot more games at first base than Joe Mauer has, even with Joe Mauer's health issues.
This year, now, yeah. Well, last year, Mauer played a lot more games at first base because Morneau was out intermittently.
Right.
And I think, I can't remember what else was going on there. I think they didn't have a true DH or anybody decent to play DH, and now they've sort of gotten Domet. But, yeah, I do. I think Mauer has played a lot for a catcher, at catcher, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, so Joe Mauer has played 45 games at catcher, 4 at first base, and 19 at DH. Carlos Santana is 46 at catcher, 13 at first base, 13 at DH. So nearly two-thirds of his time, more than two-thirds of his time has been spent not a catcher. Or sorry, more than a third of his time has been spent not a catcher. So that kind of degrades some of the value of just being a catcher.
But he's played more games as a result, right?
Mauer,
I think, has 2 days off all year. One of them 60, was in a National League state.
That's 69 it's 69 to 68, so it's not that much different. Yeah. I would have thought that too. That would be my inclination as well. Real quick on Joe Mauer too, he's having a bit of a power surge. It looks like that 2010 season, 2009 when he had 28 home runs. Hasn't done anything close to that since, but already has 10 home runs about halfway through the season so far. So, looks like he's discovered a little bit of that power. Obviously, really high average and 100 points better from betting average on base percentage. So it's hard for me to see anybody else who's worthy of the catcher as well. Similar in the NL, we all agree it's Yadier Molina. I thought this was a fluke. What he was doing like 2 years ago was a fluke. I did not see it coming, but obviously not a fluke. He continued to be amazing. The defense also was very good as a catcher. 353, which is just absurd for a catcher. And the neck tattoo, not getting in the way as well. So that's obviously good to see. Okay, outfield now.
I think he's like possibly.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think he's possibly the best defensive catcher today. And that, I think, has to have some value in the All-Star game when you come to a guy who's actually touching every pitch as opposed to just when the ball is in play.
Sure, and you're obviously playing with a bunch of different pitchers in the All-Star game as well. So you want a guy who's good behind the plate and can handle different styles and you know, different deliveries and so on and so forth. So that does.
Which is also an.
Go ahead.
For Mauer, incidentally.
Sorry, what was that on Mauer?
It's also an argument for putting Mauer back there instead of Carlos Santana, who's literally his framing is laugh-worthy.
It is. You're absolutely right. But he is on Stephen A.'s sit. So that's very important.
Yeah. That's important for the MLB All-Star game. Everybody cares who is on Stephen A's set. All right, we have a little bit of disagreement in the outfield here. Well, at least Rafael does with the rest of us. So Owen and I agree on the AL outfield. Mike Trout, Jose Bautista, and Adam Jones are who we have in some order. But Rafael, you have Adam Jones, looks like a homer pick there, Mike Trout, and Nelson Cruz. So is this another stupid fucking fantasy bump getting you into the All-Star team?
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. But, I mean, also, he's having an incredible season. He's absolutely crushing the ball. He's hitting for pretty good average for him. I mean, he's playing great. Like,
he's
I don't know
ride.
How much of it is steroid aided. It could be quite a bit. But he's obviously looking at a suspension soon. But given what I thought I was going to get when I drafted him, I mean, he's been fantastic. He's already got 19 home runs. So if he gets suspended right now and doesn't play for the rest of the season, it's not a total loss.
No,
so,
definitely not. Oh, and obviously we had the same picks, but I want to ask you, you made this argument with Everett Cabrera and the Steelers, but why don't you have Jacoby Ellsbury in your outfield? He's gone, what is it, 32 for 35 for stolen bases, hitting .289, .353, .400. So why not Ellsbury in your outfield?
Well, I think part of it is just the other guys are better by comparison. When you look at Everett Cabrera versus Gene Segura, Cabrera is actually, like, better than Segura, whereas Ellsbury, you're comparing him to Adam Jones and Jose Bautista and Mike Trout. Even Jose Bautista has 5 stolen bases, which is, like, it's amazing that he has that many, given how many home runs he's hit and what his on-base percentage is, and just sort of anchoring that entire offense the way he has been. The other thing is that Ellsbury really, like, what's his home run numbers now? Isn't it, like, 2 or 3 or something? 1? I mean, come on, man, you're playing in Boston. You're a left-handed hitter playing in Boston, playing 18 games in New York, and you can't get a few out? Give me a break. You know, where's a little bit of power would have helped him a lot there, I think.
Yeah, holy no, crap. That's fair. I mean,
things
I think...
just went down.
Yeah,
interruption here. Chicago was down 2-1 in the Stanley Cup a minute ago when I looked at this, and then we started talking about Jacoby Ellsbury, and now they're up 3-2.
Chicago?
They're about to win. There's like a minute left.
They're about to win the Stanley Cup?
They're about to win.
No, Boston's up 2-1. Wait.
Not anymore. I'm watching it live on TV.
Oh, wow. ESPN.
Oh, my God. Really?
Together.
I think they just scored twice in like 15 seconds.
Oh, shit.
Crazy. Yeah.
Well, see ya, Boston.
Yeah.
Looks like the Boston underdogs didn't quite deliver.
No, not quite this time. Not quite this time. Apparently, Jacoby Ellsbury is a curse for Boston. Very strange.
That's surprising, given what happened to him last year on my fantasy team.
Yeah.
That's another reason I can't vote for Ellsbury.
That's
what he
fair.
Did to my team last year.
Residual hate. That's definitely a good reason to keep him out of the ballot.
Although I did end up winning, in fairness.
Yeah, well, I don't remember that.
No, I've forgotten everything about it.
So let's do NL outfield right now. Owen and I both have the two cargos, those being Gonzalez and Gomez. And then we disagree on the third outfielder. He has Dominic Brown, I assume. I don't know who else is Brown.
Uh-huh.
And then I have Carlos Beltran. Rafael also has Carlos Beltran, and I assume cargo is Carlos Gonzalez there. And then you have Jay Bruce.
Yes, it is.
So why no Carlos Gomez, Rafael?
Because Jay Bruce.
Because he's on your team. All right. We can move on now.
Okay. Oh, and real analysis there. Why Dominic Brown over Carlos Beltran or somebody else?
I went with Brown. I mean, isn't he still the National League leader in home runs? How can you not have that? He might be second. But I think he's either first or second. I think he's still first. You can't have that guy not starting, and it's not like there's anything he's not doing that he should have done better to get him in ahead of, you know, Beltran's been very good, but I think he's a less exciting player than Dominic Brown right now.
Holy crap. Yeah, the Blackhawks scored 2 goals in 17 seconds.
Yeah.
Wow.
I can't believe I missed them both by looking away for 17 seconds.
Yeah, you had to talk about Jacoby Ellsbury, and that made you miss 2 goals in 17 seconds. He continues to curse you. Carlos Gonzalez actually is now the NL leader in home runs with 21. Dominic Brown has 19. So is quite behind them, tied with Paul Goldschmidt, Pedro Alvarez. Yeah, so not the NL leader in home runs anymore. Kind of undermines your argument there.
Then he gets the boost. The boost.
What's the, oh, the fantasy boost? Yeah. Yeah, fantasy boost.
He's on my team. Although he does also have, he's batting .276, which isn't going to hurt you, and 8 stolen bases.
Yeah, so. He's got a good power speed combo.
No sweat.
This is going to undermine everything I talked about for Gene Segura, but, Dominic Brown is atrocious defensively. I don't know how much you watch him in the outfield, but he cannot read a ball off the bat to save his life. I love the dude, plays for my favorite team, but the dude just cannot play defense. It's not in his game. All he can really do is hit home runs, which I'm happy with half the time. But the other half of the time, boy, it's like there's a reason that Delmon Young is playing right field and Dominic Brown is playing left field. Let's just put it that way. All right, guys, let's move to the pitching now. We'll go try to go through this a little bit quickly. We originally were going to do 3 pitchers, and then there were so many good pitchers that we had to expand it to 5. So I'll go through it. We'll start with the AL. Owen has Max Scherzer, King Felix, Chris Sale, Hisashi Iwakuma, Yu Darvish. I have something very similar. Actually, I think the same 5.
You have identical, yeah.
Yeah, it's the same 5 for me. Rafael looks like
he Rafael.
Has also yeah. the same 5. So no really, no arguments there. Does it look like we have the same 5? Oh, we almost have the same 5. Raphael's being a dick again. Owen and I agree on Clayton Kershaw, Matt Harvey, Adam Wainwright. No, we don't agree. Sorry. Owen has Clayton Kershaw, Matt Harvey, Adam Wainwright, Shelby Miller, Cliff Lee. I have Clayton Kershaw, Cliff Lee, Matt Harvey, Adam Wainwright, and Jordan Zimmerman. I'll explain my Zimmerman love in a second, but Owen, why Shelby Miller?
I mean, the guy, he's pitched out of his mind. He's clearly great. He deserves it.
Okay, but higher ERA.
He's
ER
running
Raven,
for starter. With,
higher
you know,
ERA than Jordan
Harvey
Zimmerman.
Wainwright.
Sure. Sure, but higher ERA than Jordan
yeah.
Zimmerman. Higher whip.
Yeah, I just think that Zimmerman, this isn't Zimmerman for real. I mean, the guy, his BABIP suppression is amazing because he's not striking people out and he's still putting up these numbers. But I don't think that's sustainable. Whereas I think, you know, Miller is the way that he has pitched has actually been better in the sense that he's gotten outs without allowing people to put the ball in play, which is always going to help you, you know?
I mean, obviously you'd rather take the high strikeouts over low strikeouts, but I don't see why we can necessarily say Jordan Zimmerman is more unsustainable than Shelby Miller. Jordan Zimmerman was great last year. Shelby Miller, this is his first half season in the league. I don't think we have any reason to think that Shelby Miller is any less of a fluke than Jordan Zimmerman is, especially because Zimmerman has a track record of being great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at their numbers right now, and, you know, like, you look at Miller with a .277 BABIP, an 82.3% left on base percentage, home run fly ball at 8%, which is probably about where it should be for that park. And then you look at Jordan Zimmerman, let me just bring up his numbers real quick. There are 2 Jordan Zimmermans, apparently. He's got, 78% left on base, but just a .241 BABIP. I don't think anybody's ever managed a .241 BABIP over a season as a starter. I think Pedro is, like, maybe the closest anybody's ever come.
Jordan
Zimmerman is
good
as he is. He's not Pedro.
Sure, but, I mean, obviously Zimmerman getting lucky on the bat, but I'll grant you that. But Miller getting lucky with the left on base percentage there, and, you know, it's...
Yeah,
I know,
yeah,
for
but
me it's
Zimmerman's
a lot.
At 78% and Miller's at 82%. It's not like a that far apart.
Yeah, I think Miller's got some lucky bat suppression as well there. I don't know. I don't think Miller is so far ahead. And again, there's something to be said for the young star, especially a star who's going to strike people out in the All-Star game. It's probably not going to watch be that exciting to watch Jordan Zimmerman get 3 straight ground balls to end his inning of work. But,
well, and besides that, Jordan Zimmerman looks really old. His eyes kind of sag a little bit. So.
That's true. Not very old, still very young, only 27 years old. So there's something to be said for the youth factor there. But if we're just going on merit alone, it's got to be Jordan Zimmerman. The dude's just been amazing. And, of course, getting the fantasy bump. Rafael, do you have any logical reason whatsoever for putting Lance Lynn on your All-Star ballot?
He's got those wins, baby.
That would be a no.
Win.
He's a winner.
That
he's a winner.
And no. Alrighty.
No. No.
Really quickly on the All-Star ballot, a last point on the All-Star ballot. Do you think Puig deserves to go?
No. He just hasn't spent enough time in the league. I mean, he's played incredibly well,
But his start is so hot that it's, like, obviously totally unsustainable. And we don't really know what he's playing, like, what kind of a player he is yet. So, no, I would say no.
That's the first intelligent thing Rafael has said, and I think I have to agree with him.
I mean, I see where you're coming from. I think we do have to recognize, for one, his star power, and for two, the fact that he does now have 7 home runs. I mean, he's not like a slouch or something. He's batting yeah. .425 with 7 home runs. That's more than 3 times as many as Matt Kemp has. So,
How's Kemp working out for you, by the way, Justin? I mean,
keeping that bench warm.
Well, he's not back yet, I don't think.
Oh, it's good. Good to know.
No, I do. I think that Puig deserves to go sort of the same way that Bryce Harper deserved to go last year. He's come up and played
way more games played for Harper, though.
His expectations, yes, definitely more games played, but yeah, not quite as many as maybe you'd think.
Maybe. I mean, how about this? Can we compromise and just have Yasiel Puig play the entire Futures game?
Well, we could, you know, you could put him in the vote, too. Of course, he wins the vote, because he's very popular.
Or he just does the home run derby.
With Harper, too.
Yeah, let's just put him in the derby, home run derby. Not the all-star game, but just have him.
That would be fun. That would be fun.
Yeah, we go for that. You poo-pooed that, by the way, so I don't know where your 3-6 is coming from. Owen, with your Blackhawks winning the Stanley Cup, obviously congratulations to them. You want to give
it over?
A little bit of...
Yeah.
I mean, dude, come on.
Yep.
Yeah, 2 goals. I mean, throughout the series, it seemed to me like the Blackhawks were getting fewer shots, but they were getting higher quality shots, and also that, you know, that perception, though, could just be based on Crawford's goaltending being superior to Tuukka Rask. So, I don't know. I guess I would say I'm very impressed. I'm glad they won. I'm actually sorry that I'm not able to watch it with volume, but in addition, Patrick Kane wins the Conn Smythe Trophy, so now you've got Taves and Kane, both Conn Smythe winners, and they're both coming back next year. The team could be good for a long time to come, assuming they don't kind of get screwed in arbitration the way they did the last time they won.
Yeah,
I think that model might have been changed.
I know nothing about hockey salaries there. I'll admit, I actually have watched some of this, the NHL finals. I won't pretend to be able to speak knowledgeably about it, other than that it just kind of looked like Chicago was the better team. Just from the brief, my completely uninformed watching of it, so I'm happy for them. Of course, we have to be sad for Boston, because Boston never wins anything, right, guys?
No, man, the suffering that Boston has had to go through is really terrible.
Yeah, it's just
so much suffering.
No champions there as well. All right, Rafael.
Really quick.
Go ahead.
One more quick thing about the hockey. I remember it was one of our first shows that we talked about the Blackhawks' early winning streak, and this being a historic streak, and everybody who had managed to win as many games as they had won the Stanley Cup, and then we decided they would win the Stanley Cup, and here we are today, many games later, and they do win the Cup. This might go down as one of the better Stanley Cup finals ever. There were 3 overtime games there early on, which was, I think, really a joy for the fans to watch. Once again, though, the Blackhawks win it on the road, which is a disappointment.
Yeah, well, better win it on the road than not win it at all, so can't complain too much there. Somebody who's not going to win it all this year, Rafael Nadal. Rafael Coburn, tell us a little bit about the big stumble Mr. Nadal had in today's Wimbledon.
Well, I mean, this is the first round of Wimbledon. It's not only the first round, but it's actually the first day of Wimbledon. And Rafael Nadal lost in straight sets to Steve Darcis.
Who?
Which I think I think it's probably the greatest upset in the history of the open era of tennis. Honestly, this is just a titanic upset. Steve Darcis is a talented player, because the depth of the men's game right now is absurd. But he is ranked 135 in the world to Rafael Nadal's 5. And, I mean, that number 5 ranking does not actually reflect how good Rafael Nadal is. So for him to lose in straight sets like this to Darcis is, I mean, last year's loss to Lucas Rosol was, like, one of the greatest upsets ever. This has to be the biggest upset ever. This is just totally ridiculous. Straight sets, first round. No one saw this coming. No one, there was no inkling in anyone's mind that this was even remotely possible. You know, I mean, Rafael Nadal was coming off a totally dominant stretch of tennis, winning 7 titles since he came back from injury,
just completely destroying people, won the French Open. He looked to be, like, at the top of his game. And then for him to lose in the first round of Wimbledon is so shocking. It is ridiculously shocking. This completely came out of nowhere. Now, admittedly, yeah, it appears that he is, again, having problems with his knee. And that may have played a role. I don't know how much. I mean, I watched the majority of this match, and Darcis was playing out of his mind. I mean, the guy was hitting the ball so clean, sending it really hard, hitting the lines, playing extremely smart, and he didn't choke at all, which is very impressive because this was by far the biggest win of his career. He didn't get tight. I mean, in the last game when he was serving it out, he closed it out with an ace just like Rosol did last year. But I mean, there were some incredible shots in that last game, including one like absurd running passing shot to give him a 30-15 lead in the last game to close it out. It's unbelievable. It was totally unbelievable. No one saw this coming.
Yeah, I think that you can't really emphasize that enough. This just how big of an upset this is. I think, you know, Americans who follow other sports, not tennis, are kind of used to some upsets. We see it all the time in March Madness, 16 seeds beating 1 seeds, and you know, even the best NBA teams might drop a game against a 1 seed might drop a game in the first round against the 8 seed. But for a player of Nadal's caliber to lose even a set would be an upset, but to lose a match to this guy is just completely unprecedented.
This is the first time in his career he's lost in the first round of a Grand Slam. Yeah. That includes like when he was like 16 playing Grand Slams. So, yeah. This is unbelievable. It's completely unbelievable.
You and I were talking a little bit about this prior to the show.
Really?
Oh, go ahead, Owen. Sorry.
How does this compare with Ivanisevic and his victory? What was it, 10, 11 years ago?
Yeah, in 2000.
In terms of an upset.
Over who?
Well, wasn't he didn't he get into the tournament on a wild card and he was ranked he was 150th or something?
Yeah, but that's back when the grass
was his seed in the tournament.
That's back when the grass at Wimbledon was unbelievably fast. Ivanisevic had made that final a few times and he was well regarded as one of the best grass court players in the generation. So while it's true that everyone thought his window was closed and that there was no way he was going to win that title, he was not nearly as surprising because this is a guy with a proven track record of excellence on that surface with an enormous serve. Whereas Steve Darcis is 5'10". His career high ranking is 45 in the world. He has one top 10 win in his career. So for him to beat Rafael Nadal in straight sets in the first round of Wimbledon is just absurd. It's impossible. It's the biggest upset that I've ever heard of.
Yeah.
You and I were talking a little bit before the show. Do you think this affects Nadal's legacy at all? Can we even remotely consider him as one of the greatest players of all time, given this enormous upset he suffered?
Well, I mean, one upset does not ruin his career credentials, but it makes you think about it makes you think about what his legacy should be. And his legacy is that he is clearly the greatest clay court player of all time. I mean, it's not even close. People talk about Bjorn Borg, and obviously he's the second greatest clay court player of all time, but there's no way, with the athleticism that Rafael Nadal brings to the table, that incredible forehand, the ridiculous movement on the surface, he's clearly the greatest clay court player of all time by a very wide margin, I believe. But, I mean, people look at this total of Grand Slam titles as kind of the measuring stick now for the greatness of a player's career. And Nadal's at 12, which is fantastic. It's only 5 behind Federer, but 5 is actually a lot. But, I mean, 12 Grand Slam titles is a lot of Grand Slam titles. That puts him right near the top, only 2 behind Sampras. But 8 of those are on clay at the French Open. The clay court season is very long. It's a few months in the middle of the season. It has a few Masters 1000 titles in there, which Nadal basically sweeps every year. So he's got all these records. I think he's got the record for most Masters 1000 titles, which is very, very impressive, but that's basically because he just keeps winning the clay ones. He's a former world number one, which is really impressive, but he only had a couple years when he was actually dominant on all of the surfaces. When you look at his career in total, this is a guy who I really don't think is going to win another hard court Grand Slam. I mean, he's going to have to go through Djokovic and Murray on a hard court with his knee problems. I just think that's extremely unlikely that he could put up any real fight against those guys in a best of five tournament near the end of the tournament. I think that's virtually impossible. And then you look at Wimbledon, and he's won that tournament twice, and you would think that that would suit his game pretty well now because the grass has slowed down so much in the last decade, and it's a soft surface, so it should be pretty good for his knees. But then, I mean, last year losing in the second round, this year losing in the first round, both years having a knee problem, it seems like maybe that clay court season is actually hurting him and re-aggravating his knee issues. So maybe he would have to play fewer clay tournaments. And who knows what's really going to happen to him now. But when you look at his career in like 5 or 10 years, I think you're going to see someone who obviously is one of the all-time greats. But even with his great record against Federer, you have to look at the complete package. And only 4 Grand Slam titles on surfaces that are not clay is not really good enough to put you in that elite company with a Federer or a Sampras or, you know, like a Bjorn Borg. I just don't think so. He's certainly in that group. I think he's probably going to end up in that top 5, maybe at around number 5 or 4. But unless he can really win some more hard court slams and maybe another Wimbledon or two, I just don't really think he's going to have enough to be the greatest player of all time.
Yeah, I hear you on the, you know, you don't want to overreact too much to this. You don't want to say that one upset affects how we view his whole career. But still, it's hard not to think that, you know, this would never happen to Federer or Murray or Djokovic in their primes. So it's, I don't know.
Well, but the thing is that this has happened to Murray in his prime. Djokovic,
okay, not Murray,
you know, but doesn't really lose in the first round, but he's lost early before. The thing with Federer, though, is that one of the amazing credentials, one of the many amazing credentials that he has, is that he is by far the most consistent superstar tennis has ever seen. I mean, 9 straight years in the quarterfinals of every single Grand Slam. He hasn't missed a Grand Slam in that time. I mean, it's just unparalleled consistency. His semifinal streak was broken recently, but it was over 30 consecutive semifinals in the Grand Slams, which is, I mean, totally ridiculous. He at one point had like a 12 slam streak of making the final of 12 Grand Slams in a row. Which, I mean, the guy is just so consistent when it really counts. So it's almost unfair to compare anyone to that, because we've never seen that before. That's just, yeah, it's totally unique. So I don't know how much it really hurts Rafael Nadal's legacy as much as it almost helps Federer's legacy.
That's a fair point. So with the big three that are left in Wimbledon, that'd be, of course, Federer, Djokovic, and Murray, who does this help the most with Nadal being out?
Well, it clearly helps Federer and probably Federer the most, and then Murray second. So Federer was supposed to meet Nadal in the quarterfinals. Everyone was talking about what a huge, like, incredible quarterfinal that would be. And now that's just not going to be the case. He's gone. So that has really opened up Federer's draw. You got to think pretty much a lock to make the semifinals now, where he's going to have Murray, who, you know, he beat in the Wimbledon final last year. Then Murray beat him at the Olympics, but that was a pretty different environment, a pretty unique environment for tennis. So that's going to be a tough matchup, but it helps both of them a lot because they were both on Nadal's side. Djokovic got so lucky with the draw. I mean,
yeah, really,
he had
Jesus.
Federer, Murray, and Nadal on the other side of the draw. He's been basically just sitting over there with David Ferrer, who's not even close to a threat to him. You got to think he's pretty much a lock to make the finals unless something very surprising happens. So it doesn't really affect him. He was probably going to be in that final anyway. But I'd say it helps Federer the most because, you know, no more enormous quarterfinal threat.
Yeah. Do you think that there's any threat of Federer letting off the gas? Sometimes he can be a little bit frustrated in that regard. Or do you think
he's... Oh, dude, he's on fire.
Yeah.
He is on fire. His match today, he won 3 sets in 69 minutes against Victor Hinescu, who's a big guy who serves huge. That guy's not a bad grass court player. He destroyed him. He is hot right now. I mean, since he came onto the grass, he won that 6-0-6-0 match in Halle, won that title, and now he looks good. I mean, he looks like he's on a mission. So I would watch out for Federer. I mean, 69-minute 3-set match, that's scary.
Yeah, that's crazy. Who knows how long it'll latch, but how long it will last, rather. But damn, it's fun to watch while it does. So hopefully that continues, because nobody likes Federer when he's on his game like that. All right, guys, let's bring Owen back in here for a little bit. Fist pump or fist punch? This is, of course, our excuse during our shows to talk about our fantasy teams and praise or punish people on those fantasy teams. So, Owen, who would you like to dole out your fists to this week?
Well, the fist pump is hard to give out because I've had a lot of guys who have played really well, but none of them have stood out much more of the other guys. So I'll just name them. There's Joe Mauer. Obviously, some of the power is there. Nick Franklin, which looks like, you know, he looks like a double threat, and he's picked up a lot of RBIs in the last couple weeks. Then Yasiel Puig obviously continues to just be Yasiel Puig. By the way, he's still hitting over 400. and Shane Victorino, you know, has had a good week. It's like, you know, I would love for Victorino to get healthy because he really is primed for a great year in Boston. That park is just going to be so perfect for him because he's the type of player who has the ability to just lob the ball off the green monster whenever he's hitting right-handed and pull it out down the line when he's hitting left-handed. So I would love to see him stay healthy. He's injured again, probably. So we'll see what happens with that. My fist punch is obviously the sort of what I'm going to just call a perennial fist punch. He's going to go to Billy Butler, who's just, he continues to play terribly and just be awful at baseball. What a waste of a pick that guy was. And then my other one is to me for not having Victorino in the lineup. I thought I had adjusted my lineup before my trip, and I must have forgotten to adjust some aspect of it because I missed out on Victorino going 4-for-5 with 5 REIs. So no good for me there on the management.
All right. So I have yet again the easiest fist pump in fantasy baseball. I'm going to have to give it to Miguel Cabrera, who in the last week is batting .536 with 2 home runs and 6 RBIs. What can you say about this? But, like, he's batting .536 in the last week. The average is going to just keep going up. I mean, who knows what it could be at the end of the season? It's .370 now. It could continue to get better. Could he bat .400? Maybe. Maybe he could. That seems like
he could do it.
Might be possible.
Yeah. Well,
so, obviously, epic fist pump for him.
If he played in Colorado, he would hit .400, I bet, because he would make up the deficit with some more home runs. I think he could do it.
Yeah. I'm going to have to give my fist punch to Heath Bell. I picked him up. Not so good for me. He sucks. So, probably Heath Bell.
Yeah. Well, it's nice that you gave a fist pump to Miguel Cabrera, but it still didn't put you in first place, bitch, because I remained there this week. I got a healthy lead over the second place team. My 79 points to whoever that loser is, they're 73.5. I'm going to ride this for as long as it lasts. I do not think I'm running away with this championship by any means, but I'm enjoying my place atop the fantasy crown as it stands for now. And one guy who has helped me get there is Gene Segura, who despite Owen's attempts to slander and put down, has been awesome. Over the past 7 days, has batted .400 with a home run and 4 stolen bases, has not slowed down at all, has continued to put the Baltimore glory holes atop the fantasy league there. So huge fist pump to Gene Segura. I did have over 80 points at one point, and some people who have not helped me in any regard are 2 Kansas City Royals, Salvador Perez and Alex Gordon, who both went 2-for-19 this past week. In case you can't do that math, that's a .105 batting average. And guys, yesterday, Mr. Grant Balfour did not have such a good day. If I put the over-under at 80 for his ERA, which would you take?
Well, the over.
Yeah, it was over. It was 81.
You can't have an 80 ERA. Right.
No, well, you probably could, but it would be very hard to do. It was 81. 3 earned runs in the 3rd of an inning, ruined an otherwise fine day for my pitching staff. Well, Ernesto Fieri gave up 3 earned runs in 2/3 of an inning, so wasn't so good either. But starting pitchers at least did well. Not so good when your relievers blow a save in fantastic fashion, as both of them did there. But still, atop the fantasy league, enjoying it, and hope I'd be there for the rest of the season. All right, guys, beer of the week time. Raphael, we'll start with you. Which beer would you like to recommend to our listeners this week?
So I had some really good beer this past week. I'm in Boston right now and had some really good beer up there. I had and obviously this has nothing to do with Boston because it's a Denver brewery, but I had the Great Divide Old Ruffian Barley Wine. It's just really fucking good. It's a really complete barley wine. It's got all the things that you want. It's like hoppy. It's got nice, like a really full malty flavor too. It's like not too heavy on the carbonation, but like enough that you kind of really taste the carbonation. It's just a very complete beer. It's excellent.
Very nice. My beer of the week this week is going to be the Surly Overrated West Coast IPA. That's actually the name of it, the Overrated West Coast IPA. I had not had this before. I just took my recent trip to Minneapolis, but I saw it while I was there, decided to pick it up to go along with some of the Furious that I got. And it's really, really good. It's obviously certainly makes a great IPA with Furious. So I was expecting good things with the Overrated, and I didn't disappoint. It definitely is more of the West Coast style. It's lighter in color than the Furious, and not quite as citrusy as the Furious, which is interesting. A little bit more bitter and piney than the Furious, but really, really good. Another excellent IPA to add to Surly's list. Owen, I think you're going to disappoint us this week. Any beers to recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't. My consumption has been dramatically slowed by my newfound affinity for working. So I did go to the Deschutes Brew Pub here in Bend, and which was kind of, I viewed it as a little bit of a mecca. I was disappointed that they didn't have anything really epic on tap. I was hoping that when I went there, they would have just something like absurd. And when they didn't, I was a little surprised and a little disappointed.
Yeah, for a brewery that's as highly regarded as Deschutes, you would think that they would have something there to give to their
brewery. And it was a little expensive compared to Corvallis. But in fairness, that's like, I mean, Corvallis is like the cheapest place in the universe.
Yeah, that's saying like it costs a dime instead of a nickel. Like, not much sympathy. All right, guys, last call time. The NHL and NBA have both wrapped up, so not a whole lot going on in the sporting world. But what would you like to recommend to our listeners for something to watch out for this week, Raphael?
It's got to be Wimbledon. You got probably the two best weeks of the tennis year right now. ESPN does pretty good online coverage. I think they have like 10 courts televised this year, something like that. So there's a lot of really good tennis that you can watch, especially in those early rounds this week. And then obviously the later rounds get the best tennis. But, yeah, Wimbledon these next 2 weeks, no doubt.
Owen?
One thing I have, now that I've moved to Bend, I actually have a TV, which means I can actually watch ESPN. And this is a great development in my life. I plan to watch over the next couple of hours all of the coverage on ESPN of Blackhawks' glorious victory.
Yeah, no, definitely something to revel in. I was definitely doing that when the Miami Heat won. It was great to revel in that as
Oh,
well.
Yeah. Yeah. I did that too.
Oh, yeah. It was nothing like watching SportsCenter drunk for an hour when your team's just won. Really no greater feeling than that. Speaking of great feelings, that's a wrap for Sports Symphonies this week. Please check out our website. That's sportssymphonies.wordpress.com. You can email us, sportssymphoniespodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to send anything our way, whether it's sports-related or not. We'll read it on the show because we haven't got an email yet, and we're really, really lonely. So please do take advantage of that. And, of course, if you're on the Twitter, you can follow us at Sports Symphony. I'm the only one that ever tweets, if that's okay. You can read that there. That'll do it for us this week. For Raphael Coburn and Owen McMurtry, I am Justin Freese. We are Sports Symphonies, signing off. Until next week.
Sports Symphonies is a production of Halfway House Entertainment. To get in touch with the show, send an email to sportssymphoniespodcast@gmail.com. For more information, go to sportssymphonies.wordpress.com.
It's gonna rain. It's raining sideways.